Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Thursday, the 2nd of September already. Our guest this hour says in the cover story of this month's Mother Jones magazine this, and it is fairly dramatic. BP and its partners have transformed themselves into modern-day pirates, operating beyond law or conscience. Their reckless quest has endangered and perhaps condemned not just the Gulf Coast, but the largest, richest, most pristine, most biologically important, and last completely unprotected ecosystem left on Earth, the deep ocean. Joining us this hour is Julia Whitty. She's environmental correspondent at Mother Jones and author of the story BP's Deep Secrets, which appears in the September-October issue of BP. We'll be welcoming phone calls as we talk about the aftermath of the Deepwater Horizon, which she says is different from any other spill in human history. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 41. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it's the same number. I was going to give another number. I was thinking in years past. If you would like to send an email, that is talk@wpr.org. Talk@wpr.org. So Milwaukee, Superior, Rhinelander, Green Bay, Madison, all of those places, Platteville, reach us at those numbers. Julia, thank you very much for being with us.
Having me, Kathleen.
Our great pleasure. This is a part of the ocean that we have not thought very much about, and your article draws very complete attention to the deep ocean. How has the Deep Horizon spill affected the deep ocean? And I guess another question to be asked earlier is, what is in that deep ocean?
Well, the deep ocean, I mean, I happen sort of ironically to be working on a story about the deep ocean when the disaster happened in the Gulf of Mexico. And I was working with scientists who've been studying the life within the deep ocean, and particularly in the open ocean water column. So this is not the life attached to the seafloor, which people tend to think of when they think of the deep ocean, but in fact a very rich and enormous, the largest biomass of life on the planet lives in deep open ocean waters. And in general, this huge aggregation of many, many species of fish and squid and invertebrates is referred to as the deep scattering layer. And that's an old term from echo sounding from early oceanographers who actually were looking for how deep the ocean was, and they found it was mysteriously about 3,300 feet deep during the day, but then mysteriously was only 1,000 feet deep at night. And what they had uncovered without realizing it was the fact that this deep scattering layer, this great aggregation of life forms, makes twice daily vertical migrations. That is, they rise with nightfall to the surface and sink down with sunrise back into the deep, and they live below the cusp of perpetual darkness. Now, we know very little about these animals of the deep scattering layer, except that we know that almost everything of the surface ocean that we understand and love, the whales, the dolphins, the seals, the seabirds, they actually dive down and feed on the deep scattering layer as it rises at night. So it supports most of our commercial fisheries. It supports the wildlife of the ocean that we love. And it really is the foundational driver of the oceans. And, of course, this is the area that BP contaminated knowingly or unknowingly when they chose to disperse the oil that was coming up out of the wellhead. Mm-hmm. So as we saw the pictures of the oil gushing out of the wellhead, and what was happening is if they just let that oil gush up, it would have been buoyant, it would have largely floated up to the surface, where it could have been skimmed or scooped. But they hit it with this dispersant at the wellhead, and they turned it into a cloud of incredibly fine droplets of oil that now remains in the deep, unable to rise, unable to fall, maybe destined to travel in there for a really long time. Mm.
And we don't think about that. We, as you talk about, think about the oil that washes ashore, but relatively little oil, as you say, washes ashore at first, that it's trapped in this area that you're talking about. We don't think about that at all.
Yeah, the difference with this oil spill from any other one that we've had is because BP was dispersing it at 5,000 feet deep. a fairly small amount of the oil ever came ashore. And it's now riding these deep underwater currents, traveling around, locked in the deep. Well, we have problems with that, obviously. We have this deep scattering layer of animals that are migrating twice every day from the deep to the surface. And they're having to pass through, at least some of them, these plumes of dispersed oil. So this is a very dangerous thing to add into the mix of this already, you know, the scientists I was working with who are studying these animals of the deep scattering layer and those who feed on the deep scattering layer. What we see is, you know, these animals are always living on the edge. They're always barely making it. Their metabolic requirements are it just is the highest they can manage to with the output of energy required to collect fish and so on. You add a stressor, an enormous bunch of stressors like this, and it could really mean doom for some of these.
And how will we know? How do we scientifically gather evidence and look at this deep ocean to determine the devastation that's being wrought in that deep scattering layer?
Well, I think one of the interesting results of this disaster have been that the tools of science, the optics of science have switched gears, and people are staring into the Gulf of Mexico now like never before. And interestingly, I mean, when I first spoke with scientists early in the course of the spill, they were concerned because relatively little study has been done of the Gulf of Mexico ecosystems. And it's very difficult to work out there, as you might imagine, far offshore and in the dark. And so there's really, we don't know much yet, and there wasn't much good what science calls baseline data. So it's going to be very hard to do before and after comparisons because we don't know what was there before. This, of course, will play to BP's favor when it comes around to figure this stuff all out in court. But we know, we understand from deep scattering layer studies done in other parts of the oceans, that, you know, this is tremendously important. So it's a very tough world that we're only beginning to decipher.
Isn't it rather astounding, Julia, that we don't know what was there before and yet we're allowing massive drilling in this area?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of one of the major points I was trying to make with the article is, you know, that we're lagging so far behind our treatment of the ocean compared to our treatment of the land. We understand now that we need to assess the impacts of some of these really large-scale, potentially deadly activities that we undergo. We need to assess those. We have some sense of looking at that on the land, and at least there's often a battle that may go on before things will get okayed. And in the ocean, obviously, we were just writing blank checks and letting the drilling industry, you know, do whatever they wanted. And if there's any good to come out of this, and there may be a few things of good that might trickle out of this, one of them would be that we seriously reexamine the way we allow people to drill offshore in the deep.
Right. That would make sense. You have a picture in the article of the Gulf's other time bombs, including, and this is an astounding number, 33,000 mines of pipeline and 50,000 wells. You could look at that and say, well, it's surprising that we haven't had more huge catastrophes, but look what one does and look at the chance of other catastrophes with that many wells.
Yeah, well, in fact, there's slow-motion catastrophes going on in the Gulf all the time as a result of exactly that. 33 miles of pipeline delivering some of the oil and the natural gas through into the shoreline of Louisiana and thereabouts. 50,000 holes punched into the floor of the Gulf of Mexico. None of them monitored, really. I mean, most of them somewhat capped and abandoned. We know that after the passage of Hurricane Katrina came through the Gulf of Mexico, that between leaking pipelines and popping wellheads and broken storage facilities and this, you know, leaking boats and this, that, and the other thing, that about 8 million gallons of oil spilled into the Gulf of Mexico, which is about the same amount, nearly as much as the Exxon Valdez spilled. This is such an ongoing chronic situation in the Gulf that it doesn't even really garner any attention.
Hmm. I know, Julia, that you were aboard a Greenpeace boat 6 weeks after the Deepwater Horizon. Tell me where you were and some of the extraordinary images that you saw.
Yeah, we were working in the waters of Barataria Bay, which was getting a lot of attention at that time. And because it was sort of ground zero for where a lot of the oil was coming ashore initially. And it's also home to many fantastically wonderful seabird breeding colonies. So the brown pelicans were breeding there, these lovely birds called roseate spoonbills, white pelicans, all kinds of seabirds on these little tiny fragile islands. And we were working the waters of the bay and watching, you know, the fishermen who'd been hired by BP to put out containment boom around these islands to try to prevent the oil from getting onto the islands. But in fact, I was out on Barataria Bay quite a lot, and we found that the boom operations to be largely useless. I mean, more often than not, they trapped oil inside them rather than kept it out, because it would just take a small amount of wave or wind chop to just blow that water with the oil in it right over these little, you know, 6-inch-high booms. And once behind it, it was more than likely to be trapped in there. We also saw dolphins, and this was perhaps the saddest thing.
Oh, I imagine.
Yeah, we found in the tidal rip where the currents were coming and going and collecting, and where this is an edge that dolphins often fish along, because it's a very important place where a lot of animals collect on these edges of currents. And they were working this edge and fishing, but it was covered with oil. And we could see that they were struggling to live in this oil, and they were breathing oil fumes, and they were covered in oil. They have no eyelids. Their eyes I mean, they have eyelids, but they're going to have to be blinking in there with their, you know. So, yeah, just a terrible, very, very sad reality.
You describe in great detail what's happened to the plants and animals in that bay, and discuss the fact that the fate of the marshes is inextricably linked to the fate of the deep ocean and vice versa. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, the marshlands of Louisiana are really, I refer to them as the womb of the Gulf of Mexico, because it's where all the new life is brought forth. So an awful lot of the marine life that we know, including some very important commercial species like critically endangered western bluefin tuna, they, after they spawn, they're a little young, and a lot of marine life goes through funny little stages that are very different from what they're going to look like as adults. But these larvae migrate into the marshes, into the shallow, protected waters, and they live in there until they get a little bit bigger and transition into juveniles and head back into the Gulf of Mexico. So these wetlands of southern Louisiana are home to shrimp and almost all the fish you'd ever imagine, and they're the breeding islands for birds. And they were already under tremendous threat from just problems of mainly the Mississippi River having been so channelized that, you know, all the great sediment that huge river is carrying down from the breadbasket of the United States and depositing into the Gulf of Mexico, well, that's what built all these fragile wetlands and these fragile islands. And we've been channelizing the flow of that river for decades now. It enables shipping to come through without having to worry about shifting shoals and things like that. But it's been depriving the wetlands and the marshes of their lifeblood, which is the sediment. It's the runoff from the farms of, you know, Minnesota and Wisconsin coming down to enrich the Gulf of Mexico. So we know that those marshlands have been retreating. I think at the rate I've got it in my article, I think it's something like a football field every 30 minutes. I have been losing that much land. So they've been under assault. And now we know that with the oil coming in, the problem with this thick crude washing up into the marshes is it settles down onto the floor in the muck, and it deprives the muck of getting any oxygen, and so the roots of the plants die, and the next big storm or even small storm that comes through just rips them off at the roots and greatly accelerates the rate of wetlands loss.
Can you talk a little bit, which is keeping us perhaps from getting some of the story here, you include in the article the press restrictions that took place immediately after this horrendous oil spill. Did you face any restrictions in putting this elaborate story together, and are there still restrictions on the press?
Yeah, I faced a lot of them when I was down there collecting this information. I mean, everywhere you went, it was actually incredibly difficult, and it was frightening. I had a hard time sort of realizing I was in my own country, to tell you the truth. because I would just be driving down a road. I mean, and I would see a station up in the marshes where they were deploying all the booms. So it might be barges coming up and just massive piles of boom. And I would try to stop and talk to some of the guys or get a photograph, and they wouldn't speak to me. And maybe some young guy would, out of the side of his mouth, say, "We can't talk to you." I encountered it with fishermen who were hired by BP. They were hiring them really just to prevent them from getting so angry that they'd go burn down BP offices somewhere. But they would just be sitting out on their in their boats on the marshes doing nothing but getting paid. I would ask them how they were doing, and most of them would say, "We can't talk to you. We've signed non-disclosure agreements." Mm. Some of them would talk to me. But the ability of, and also BP went in and bought up all the hotel rooms. It was literally impossible.
I didn't know that.
To get a hotel room near the spill site. So I had to drive every day to and from New Orleans, which is a lot of driving. I was driving very early in the morning, very late into the night, just trying to come and go from where things were happening.
We welcome phone calls for Julia Witte, environmental correspondent for Mother Jones Magazine, author of their cover story for this month and the month of October, which is titled, excuse me, my pages are stuck together here, The BP Cover-Up, The Truth Is Down There. Well worth a read. Our number, here it is, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 from anywhere you happen to be listening this morning. And our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Chrissy Pease is doing on-air production for us today, and we'll be answering phone calls, and we'll get you on the air as soon as we can. Lines are open right now, which would be a good time for you to call. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We start our phone calls with Dan, who's on the road. Hi, Dan. Oh, Dan. Hi. Go right ahead.
Yeah, Kathleen, thanks for taking my call and for having this program. This is Dan Small with Milwaukee Public TV.
Hi, Dan.
Hi. I was actually down in the same area, Military Bay, in July with a TV crew. We are doing a special. In fact, we're finalizing production on it this week. It'll air sometime in October.
Oh.
And we found, just as Julia found or mentioned there, that the story is much bigger than just oil. It is the destruction of the Gulf Coast over the last 70 years because of the channelization of the Mississippi, as she mentioned. And everything that she's saying, I can corroborate from firsthand experience. We did, however, have pretty good access to people and to areas to the videotape. However, there wasn't much oil to see because it was all dispersed. It was not floating on the surface. We saw very little on the surface. We did have lodging at a fishing camp in Burris, about an hour north of Venice, and then we spent a day in Venice at the marina and went out with fishing guides. And all of them were either working for BP or working for Fish and Wildlife Service or the National Wildlife Federation, which is the group that put our trip together. So I commend her on this article, and I'm actually going to pick up a copy on my way to the studio to make sure I've got the latest information on the very things we're working on.
We'll look forward very much to that show sometime in October.
Yes. I'm not sure of the exact date. There will be a preview showing October 7th, and I think that's an invitational thing that the Channel 10 offers to its some of its donors, but it will air later in the month.
All right, and I'm sure Julia would like to see what you're doing as well, so there should be a way for that to happen. Dan Small works for our public television station here in Milwaukee and does a fine show on the outdoors, Julia, so that's interesting information. He agrees with what you say.
Yeah, I'm looking forward. I hope I can actually get a chance to see that. And, in fact, when I was down there, the situation with regards to sort of BP trying to sort of corral and hold down the press did start to lift towards the end of when I was down there. I think what happened is they were receiving so much bad press for doing it because, basically, they had a ton of enraged reporters.
Well, I imagine.
Yes, not a good thing. Really bad management, you know. And so they did eventually start to lessen that and lift it up, and I was able to get to places that otherwise I was having to sneak into, which I did in the early going, and I was quite happy to try and do it. Sometimes I got away with it, and sometimes I didn't. But, yeah, it was a very scary moment, frankly, in our history, looking at how this corporation was able to take control of essentially the coastline of the United States and run it like it was their own country. And it was very effective, and it was very frightening. It's something I hope I never encounter again.
Here's an email that's come in, and I know you devote a good portion of your long article to this. Did BP secure special permits to use dispersants on the oil spill? It's my understanding that the Coast Guard does not allow the use of dispersants. Can you explain the process of how this happened?
Well, I think in the initial going, they were doing it without any permit. I think they just went at things as fast and furious as they could. I just would like to back up for a second and say that in my article, I think the main reason that they were using dispersant at the wellhead 5,000 feet down without, by the way, toxicological studies ever having been done on this dispersant, without the company that produces it ever having admitted what its ingredient list was. So we have no way of knowing what the effects of that dispersant are, except we know enough to know it's also very toxic. And maybe more toxic than oil alone is dispersant.
Oh, my goodness.
Toxin. Yeah. But we know that they were, after Exxon Valdez, there were new laws put into place. Oil companies were going to be held accountable to a fine of between $1,000 and $4,300 per barrel of oil spilled. Well, what happens? So BP clearly decides, well, what if we don't let it float up to the surface where it can easily be counted? What if we disperse it at 5,000 feet down where it may never come to the surface? How will they – we'll have a really good case in court. It'll be very hard to determine how many millions of barrels were actually spilled.
Bill is next on the road. Hi, Bill.
Yes, actually, I did pull over. I'm not one of those idiots who drives with my cell phone glued to my ear. But anyway, it appears that the fix is in. I mean, the United States. First of all, I don't think BP could have done it this way. Managed the situation, the press situation down there without the cooperation of the U.S. government. I think that the creepiness of it reminds me of the embedding of reporters, you know, that the U.S. Military does, in Iraq and Afghanistan. But it appears that the fix is in. They're going to get away with it. Yes, it's nice that the story is out, but what can be done about it at this stage of the game? It seems to me like the bad news is out there, but once again, they're going to get away with it. And I'd like to hear, first of all, is there anything that can be done? And, I mean, what possible lesson is there in this other than the bad guys are going to win again?
Thank you, Bill, for the call. Julia.
Thanks, Bill. Yeah, I understand that point of view. And I tell you, after being there, I feel it too. I do think, though, that we have the potential for some important new pathways in our future to come out of this event. You know, if we take a look at the 1969 oil spill off California in Santa Barbara, many states outlawed offshore drilling after that thing. After Exxon Valdez, and 20 years after that in 1989, we actually put in place some regulations to really strengthen tankers, to put in the double hulls that hopefully would prevent similar spills like that. 21 years after that, we have another giant spill, and we have opportunities with this spill, and that those opportunities include taking a look at what could we do going forward. Now, obviously, we should have done this in hindsight, but it wasn't done. So all we can do now is take a look going forward. What can we do to prevent this? And I think there are a bunch of opportunities offered to us here. Again, we can reexamine the realities of offshore drilling. Maybe we can look at ways of really giving environmental impact statements to the deep ocean and awarding that area some respect. We can also take a look at our whole fossil fuel industry. I mean, this I say at the end of my article, that in fact what was being laid down out there with all this oil was a new layer in the sediment record of the Gulf of Mexico, which I said will someday be known as the BP dark layer. And I hope that that is the seam that marks the beginning of a change from our dependence on this dirty energy into a world in the future where we have clean energy. So this is just part of the cost of what we call cheap oil. It's in a very expensive cost. So hopefully we can move forward on that. Maybe. I mean, there was so much anger in the – I sensed it at least. I don't know. Maybe I was just in the middle of it. But it seemed to me like there was a lot of anger in this country about BP whole corporate structure. And maybe this is a chance for us to try to tackle that as well.
And yet your article includes a timeline titled BP's Damage Control, and the end is August 1st. 31 of 33 deepwater rigs in the Gulf are still operating. Does that mean that they're all pretty safe?
No, they probably aren't safe, and it's something we really are going to have to do. And I will say, you know, it's a collective all of us, because frankly, none of us were looking at what was going on out there. Scientists weren't talking about the risks that were being taken. Engineers were engineering the risks being taken. The public was oblivious. The media was turned off. Environmentalists didn't even have it on their radar screen. So, you know, it's been a wake-up call for absolutely every one of us. And I think we need to stay vigilant. And, you know, it's one of our duties as citizens, in my opinion, is we remain and are always vigilant of our own government and of our corporate structure, which too often seems to run our government.
And yet, I was watching the news last night, BP has spent $98 million on their advertising campaign to talk about all they're doing to make things right.
I know, I saw that.
$98 million, Julia, that's a lot of money.
I know, but you know, can you imagine money that was more wasted? Did it dent one single opinion? I can't believe it did. You know, did anybody go, oh yeah, right, BP, good job. You know, they just threw that money away. Some advertising execs got richer on that one.
Yeah. Our number, we have some lines open. Thank you, Bill, for your call. 800-486-8655. Julia Whitty, environmental correspondent at Mother Jones, author of Deep Blue Home, an intimate ecology of our wild ocean. And she is the author of the cover story, The BP Cover Up. The truth is down there. It's in the September-October issue of Mother Jones magazine. We also have an email you can use, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And here's an email from Tom in Wausau, Julia. I'm shocked that anyone is surprised by BP's outrageous conduct. They own Congress and the regulatory agencies. After all, we have the best government, corporate, and special interests can buy.
Yeah, I mean, it is. That's part of what I think we really need to look at as citizens, is reclaiming our government from the huge lobbying. I mean, I think I read about this just recently, that ExxonMobil spent something like 20 times more in Washington lobbyists than every environmental group combined.
Oh, my goodness. You know,
yeah, they're huge. They're powerful. They arguably are way too deeply embedded in government. Talk about embedded. And we need to really seriously take our representational system away from them. You know, government was set up to represent us, the public, and we need to have it do that for us. BP, no matter what they say, no matter what money they spend on ads, they are only representing their shareholders. We are the people that our government is supposed to represent.
Anne in Madison, hi.
Hi. Well, Mother Jones does incredible investigations. This is an interesting program. I heard on another program, it might have been on Wisconsin Public Radio, that BP had paid hydrogeologists and other professors and researchers as much as $100,000 not to talk to the press and to keep quiet about what they knew, and that they were using prisoners from Louisiana prisons who would be punished in various ways, probably by having time added to their sentences or loss of time, you know, so-called good time accrued, if they refused to work cleaning up, and of course without any protection at all, because as the lawyer Mike Papantonio said, that was bad optics. But I really wanted to say that Parade magazine that comes in Sunday papers has someone named who calls herself anyway, Marilyn Vaux-Savant, I think. And somebody wrote in last week or the week before asking whether drilling in deep, you know, under the Earth's crust and drilling in general caused shifts in the weight of the Earth and hence led to earthquakes. You know, it causes hollows under the surface. And she said, absolutely, it does. So all this deep water drilling is could be, one major cause of all the earthquakes we've been having recently. And it could be extended to this constant bombing the United States is doing all over the world.
Julia.
Yeah, hi. Well, thank you for that, Anne. And we do know that, I mean, I live in an area where there's a pretty good tap on some geothermal energy. And we know that tapping into that geothermal energy on shore does set up little small local earthquakes. And the people who live around this geothermal energy plant are highly annoyed because they're constantly undergoing little temblors that are basically breaking stuff in their houses all the time. So I don't know that drilling industry has the ability to really trigger large-scale events far away. I don't know that that is and has anything to do with what seems to be a rise in earthquakes, but actually isn't really. It's kind of within the geological norm at the moment. I do think, though, that more important is the fact, as I mentioned before, that we have this 33,000 miles of pipeline underlying the Gulf of Mexico, and a study that was done based on the track of Hurricane Ivan that went through the Gulf in 2004, I think, and they were able to have seafloor sensors, and they determined that the passage of these big cyclonic storms has the ability to break pipeline up to 300 feet deep and for as much as a week after the passage of the storm. So all of this pipeline, all of this intense infrastructure, and I don't think you could imagine what the infrastructure is like down there. I mean, I refer to it as an urban ocean. At any moment, I would look out on the horizon of the Gulf of Mexico, and with my naked eye, I could count more than 200 rigs on the surface.
Oh, my gosh.
It's like nothing. It's like future world. It's like nothing you could ever imagine. But these, all of this structure that's piping in gas and oil and whatnot is extremely vulnerable to the violent weather that goes on down there. And so we are really... It's a terrible gamble every single time, and I think it's a sad reality that the people of southern Louisiana have, you know, Florida said no to all that and has allowed no drilling off its coast. But, you know, it came in at a time when it started at an early time when the people in, I think it was maybe even as early as the Great Depression, and people were really desperately in need of work. And so they've allowed development to go on offshore there that virtually anywhere else in the world would reject. And maybe we need to revisit some of this, at least in terms of safety.
Mm. Anne, thanks for the call. Camille in Frankfort, Michigan. Hi.
Hi. What I'm wondering is, where are the scientists, the men and women, who are the only ones who can arm themselves with the facts? I mean, they publish articles and write books, perhaps, but can't they cooperate and organize to do something, as I said, arming themselves with the facts, to do something about the fact that the corporations still are holding all the cards? There's nothing that anyone else can do or say that is more that carries more credibility than what the scientists would say. And if the comment that the last caller made about them being paid off is part of the answer, then that is so incredibly disturbing.
Well, thanks for that, Camille. And that brings up a couple of interesting points. Yes, in fact, BP was going around to particularly Gulf Coast scientists and universities and offering lucrative contracts. And I think I've seen the order of $250 an hour to scientists to basically make sure that whatever data they collect goes only to BP and nobody else. And there were some scientists and some institutions that accepted this deal, and then they also signed confidentiality agreements, or non-disclosure agreements. But then there were many, many other scientists who went, no way, and went public with it. So, in fact, what I've noticed in this story, and I've been covering science for a long time, is that I saw a very encouraging development, and I saw many scientists who actually rushed, in a way, to release some of their findings on stuff that maybe they were working on that bore some importance to this developing story with the Gulf oil spill, and they put that stuff out early on, maybe in advance of publication, just to have it be in the mix. And I saw, in fact, a rising up of scientists, the likes of which I've never seen before, and that was to actually engage in this process. They were mad. They were angry. And they were sick at heart. I met with many of them who I've worked with in the past down there on other stories. They were broken and demoralized, and they knew that their research, the stuff they'd been studying and researching, was never going to be the same. The course of their careers all shifted as a result of this spill, and they know that they're going to be studying this for the rest of their lives. So they were angry about it, and they actually wanted to be heard. And so that's another positive development. I mean, you know, we actually saw the beginning of an emerging sort of, I think, consciousness in scientists that maybe they need to speak a little louder now in voicing their concerns about some of the things that are being done.
Maybe they need a $98 million campaign on television.
Yeah. Well, in fact, one of the things that I talked with some people down there that I think, you know, there was the Gulf Coast Fund that BP put up to fund all the people who were going to be hurt with their jobs and their businesses and whatnot. And really, we need a similar fund developed to pay out for the ecosystems down there. Because if we don't resurrect those ecosystems, those people still aren't going to have jobs. You know, we all depend on the ecosystems that support us, no matter how urban our lifestyles. We all need the water and the food and the air and all of the services that these living things create that make our world livable. So maybe we can develop a fund like that in the future.
Julia Witte is our guest, environmental correspondent at Mother Jones, author of the cover story. She has spent quite a bit of time in the Gulf and quite a bit of time doing environmental stories. The cover story for the September-October issue is the BP cover-up, The Truth Is Down There. I'm Kathleen Dunn. We're welcoming your calls at 800-486-8655. And the email address is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Julia, this caught my attention. Well, most of the article caught my attention, but you write that the Gulf of Mexico is already home to the second largest dead zone on Earth. The last thing it needs is another. What about that dead zone, and how will we know, and when would we know if this spill will create another?
Well, the dead zone that currently occurs every spring and summer in the Gulf of Mexico is at the mouth of the Mississippi River, and it's partly due to the same dynamics that I described with the building of sediment down there in the delta. And it's a result of the fertilizers and washing off the breadbasket of the U.S. and shuttling downstream through the Mississippi River and being dumped out into the ocean. Well, those fertilizers fertilize the plants of the ocean every bit as effectively as they fertilize the plants of the land. And what happens is you get these very intense blooms of plankton, the phytoplankton, the plant plankton, and too much even for their prey, their predators to eat. And so they die in huge mass, fall to the bottom, and the decomposers who bloom to feed on all these dead plants actually use up all the available oxygen in the water. We get these zones of very low oxygen that almost nothing can survive, and some jellyfish can survive. The Gulf of Mexico, there at the mouth of the Mississippi, has the second largest dead zone that forms every year. It's the second largest dead zone on Earth, and it's continuing to grow. There's been a lot of, I've written about this in the past, and there's been a lot of effort to try and mitigate some of the problems, and fairly simple efforts that would not cripple agriculture, a lot to do with maybe limiting winter fertilization, putting down the fertilizer. So, and, you know, I've written about that. What happens now is an interesting, different thing. What scientists have found some evidence of in the deep is that by dispersing that oil at the wellhead, BP has made these plumes of sort of clouds of fine droplets of oil and gas and mixed with dispersant. Well, in fact, because the Gulf of Mexico has had natural seepage of oil and gas down there long before we were drilling for it, there are actually communities that have evolved to feed on oil and gas. And the primary production in some of these communities is done by plants and things, not who harvest sunlight, but who harvest the energy from oil and gas. What happened is scientists have found evidence that as these plumes have been circulating in the currents of the Gulf of Mexico, these microbes that feed on oil and gas have been gathering perhaps into, and feeding on these plumes, and they are finding some evidence of low oxygen waters around these plumes, and that is because the idea is that you've got a huge bloom of these microbes, and they're using up all the available oxygen in the water. So this has been a concern, is hypoxic or low oxygen zones in the middle of the water column where, as far as anyone knows, they've never happened before out there in the Gulf of Mexico. Further concern for all those rich aggregation of life of the deep scattering layer.
Mm-hmm. Chris in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. It's a fascinating program. I guess my observation would be is, you know, gas station owners have to have monitoring equipment and put in all kinds of special things and double wall tanks and all of this. What does BP have to do for the offshore wells to make sure that they're monitoring things and that things work? It just seems like that's lacking there.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. I agree. And, I mean, I think the stories that have come out in the wake of this about the, you know, the Minerals Management Service, which is the U.S. branch of government that was supposedly overseeing drilling industry, was basically just accepting bribes and gifts, just the most blatant corruption that was going on within that industry. So horrifying that, in fact, you know, they've had to rename that industry in the wake of this spill. It's no longer called the Minerals Management Service because it's been so tarnished. So they have a new, I think it's called the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management and Regulation, something like that. And, you know, we need to do more than change the name, obviously. So, in fact, new regulations came out, new guidelines for employees of that organization to follow, hopefully to, you know, get off the corruption bandwagon and become what they need to be, which is representatives of us, the citizens, overseeing, you know, the work offshore of these enormous oil giants.
That would make sense. You include that in the article. You ought to write an article just about that. It seems to me as though they may need some new employees as well.
People
who care about what they do.
Exactly. And people maybe not rotating in and out of between government and corporate employment, you know. I mean, this is a problem when you have people that are doing a stint in the government knowing that if they, you know, if they're nice to the corporate guys, they're going to have a cushy job once they leave government. We, you know, this is just not a very tenable situation. We need to examine how it is that we interface, you know, with government and corporations.
Julia, what do you say, and you hear this from people every now and then, that we need to pay attention to this, but don't worry, our planet is incredibly resilient. That these organisms will find a way to stay alive. It might be a temporary setback, but everything's going to be okay because of the way the Earth is.
Well, I would say they've got part of it right, and that is our Earth is incredibly resilient. I mean, if it wasn't, we would have already ruined it. But the truth is, I've been saying throughout the cause of this disaster in the Gulf that for every effort of energy we make to help those ecosystems recover, nature will put in 100 units of energy. I mean, we can only do a tiny bit. The natural resilience of systems is extraordinary. But I will say that we as a species are taxing every system of this Earth pretty much to breaking point now. So we take a look at the Gulf of Mexico. We have so many endangered species there. The population of sperm whales in the northern Gulf of Mexico was estimated a couple of years ago that if even three animals died outside of natural causes, i.e. by human causes, it could jeopardize the entire population in the northern Gulf of Mexico. We have western bluefin tuna, which were up to be listed as endangered species, very hard for fish to get that listing, and was rejected earlier this year. And now we know that not only they were supposed to be spawning in the waters around the wellhead at the time of the BP blowout, and not only were they going to be spawning there, and their young were going to go into the marshlands of Louisiana, and the adults were going to be diving down to 3,000 or more feet deep into the deep scattering layer to feed. So we've compromised the entire critically endangered species, western bluefin tuna. We know brown pelicans just had come off the endangered species list. Maybe they're going to end up being put back on it after this. We have Kemp's Ridley sea turtles. They breed only in the Gulf of Mexico, the most endangered turtles on Earth. These are events that can take these species and knock them so far down that they will not come back.
Mm-hmm.
So nature is resilient, but only up to the breaking point. It's like metal. You can bend it and bend it and bend it, and then you hit that point, and it's just going to snap. And we probably hit some snapping points in the Gulf of Mexico with this disaster.
Thank you, Chris, for the call. Brian is next. Hi, Brian.
Hey, how are you doing today? I'm glad. It took me 20 minutes to get to you, and 25 minutes, and it's well worth the effort of listening to this wonderful show. I had 3 points here. I'll knock it down to a couple of them. First of all, I wanted to argue with you about the issue of the $98 million being a critical piece of money for BP Amoco. The reality is that it's about 3 to 4 days' worth of profits at the pump. It means nothing to them. Secondly, the problem that comes up out of the Gulf of Mexico is not a multinational company's concern, because they can move from the Gulf of Mexico and go off Indonesia and still maintain even higher profits. And I'll bring up the third point. I argued with a friend of mine, and it was not, and he posited something that was kind of an interesting thing. BP, in choosing the methodology they had to close the well cap, went back to week one and essentially did what they did on week one for all intents and purposes. It was not in BP's best interest to cap the wellhead, he said. And it was an interesting commentary, because what happened was they can change a political flux pretty easily. They do not want to limit offshore drilling, and by putting people in their pockets economically, so to speak, by depriving them of their wealth, of their livelihood, they're at an advantage to be able to hire and fire at will. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the call, Brian. Julia.
Well, that was a lot, and we don't have a lot of time
right.
left, but I agree that it's for certain that these multinational companies do just haul up and leave areas, and they'll go drill elsewhere. So this is a situation. Obviously, we need to address it within our own world, but it's a global reality. I mean, we have the problem off Nigeria, where just hundreds of millions of gallons are just leaking and spewing and being dumped out there constantly. Those poor people are living in the middle of what looks like an Exxon Valdez every day of their lives, and I can't even imagine what the ecosystem of the ocean is doing. So again, this is what I'm saying is the opportunity to take a look. Is this BP dark layer of oily gunk that's been laid down on the floor of the Gulf of Mexico, is this our opportunity to turn a corner and really say, let's take a look at clean energy? The costs of cheap oil are too high. And we now is our opportunity to really say, let's turn away from that future, which simply leads to more and more of this, because we're going to have to drill farther and farther out of the frontiers using more and more dangerous technology, and that we're going to be risking things like this increasingly in the future. So is this our chance to move forward and start saying, no, I don't want that future, I don't want that path?
So
we can start to demand that.
Have we done that, do you think, Julia? Have
no,
we turned
I don't
the corner?
Think we've done it as citizens at all. I mean, I think we've been incredibly complacent with the sources of our oil and the meat and our. We've been very complacent with squandering energy. I mean, we use far more energy than any other nation on Earth per capita. We're just beyond the pale, frankly. We need to look at that. Why are we doing that? Can we start to say no to that? Can we begin to embrace, you know, the subsidies that are given to oil companies? Can we put this into subsidizing the development of clean energy? Because it's going to require that to have it happen, to have it really become economically viable in the short term. We're going to have to decide to use some of our collective energies and money to spend in development of it.
So what articles are you working on now?
Well, that's tough. top secret, but I have a bunch of stuff in the pipeline. I'm never going to live long enough to write everything I want to write. But yeah, so I have a new book I'm working on and several new articles that I have in the pipeline.
Well, may you live a long, 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 long life, Julia.
Thank you, Kat.
Thank you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Wonderful, very wonderful show.
Thank you. Julia Whitty, environmental correspondent at Mother Jones. And she has the cover story, a very thorough examination of what has happened in the Gulf, and also a look at things that have not been reported on very much, and that's that deep shattering layer, which will be deeply affected by this horrendous oil spill. The Mother Jones September-October issue, the cover story is the BP cover-up. The truth is down there. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production as well here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up in just one moment, and we'll return with our Thursday morning conversation for the 2nd of September with a very interesting story. It's probably somebody you've never heard about, but you will soon hear about George Price and the search for the origins of kindness. The author of The Price of Altruism will be joining us coming up in just a moment. Thanks for listening to this hour.